pleased to be the source of such quality electoral entertainment.
The vote count for House District 34 is now a tie. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a loud morning surprise in Unalaska when a Shell vessel engine coughs during startup.
It's almost like a backfire, a ginormous backfire is what I would equate it to, but because of the size of the vessel, it's pretty big.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
BP has agreed to plead guilty and pay a $4.5 billion fine to settle federal criminal charges surrounding the Deepwater Horizon blowout and spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 people were killed in the 2010 explosion. The Anchorage Daily News reports that the company could be on the hook for billions more as the federal government plans to pursue a civil claim for violations of the Clean Water Act. More than 4 million barrels of oil were released into the Gulf of Mexico from the blowout. The race for House District 34 is all tied up. Haynes Republican Representative Bill Thomas and Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins now each have 4,054 votes. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS has more.
On Friday morning, Division of Elections Director Gail Finumiai said the office counted two question ballots from Port Alexander. Both went to Christ Tompkins. He was trailing Thomas by two votes after more than 2,100 absentee ballots were counted earlier this week. But the vote counting isn't over. Finumiai said at least 85 absentee ballots will be counted Monday, and there's a potential for up to 128 more to be received in time for the final vote count on Wednesday. At that point, Christ Tompkins said he anticipates a recount.
Yeah, with anything this close, I think it makes sense to have maximum diligence.
Thomas agreed that a recount is likely. If the two men are tied up after the final vote count, the state automatically schedules and pays for a recount, according to Finumiai. She says if less than 20 votes, or half a percentage point, separates the two candidates, then the defeated candidate can officially request a recount and it will still be paid for by the state. If there is a wider margin of difference, the candidate behind on votes can request a recount but must pay a deposit. In the meantime, Christ Tompkins said he's home in Sitka trying to stay upbeat about the long process.
I mean, we're just having a whole lot of fun right now. It's just because it's, I mean, you know, this calendar of vote counting couldn't be scheduled in a more sort of maximally entertaining fashion. So we're pleased to be the source of such quality electoral entertainment.
Thomas, on the other hand, doesn't see a bright side in all of this. He's still disappointed in the loss of representation for the district among House committees and leadership. Without a clear winner in the race, the Republicans assigned committees and chairs without Thomas, who served as co-chair of finance the last 2 years.
What's sad is that we lost the co-chairs of finance for Southeast. I think there's no way to recover from that, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to.
Christ Tompkins said the ongoing vote counting does make it challenging for him to either move on from the election or make plans to move to Juneau.
So yeah, I'm, you know, sort of on background, having conversations with potential staffing hires and trying to learn the ins and outs about legislative rules and offices, session dates, planning the calendar, that kind of thing.
Meanwhile, Thomas said he's occasionally going into his legislative office in Haynes, but otherwise hunkered down at home, awaiting results and working on next season's fishing gear.
Right now, I'm sitting here tying halibut gear. Life goes on.
Reporting in Haynes, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
A contained engine backfire explosion aboard Shell's Noble Discoverer drill rig sent fire crews in Unalaska scrambling this morning. Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin says she felt the blast from the harbor office, which is about 200 yards away.
It's almost like a backfire, a ginormous backfire is what I would equate it to, but because of the size of the vessel, it's pretty big. And so when we looked out, you could actually see the smoke coming out of the top of the landing pad there. And so it was one of those, we need to make a call and make sure it doesn't get out of control.
McLaughlin says stack fires are common aboard vessels, but can get out of control. She says this one didn't, and that the Noble Discoverer's crew responded quickly.
When we finally did get a hold of them on the radio, they did request shoreside assistance. So they weren't sure where it was leading.
McLaughlin later clarified that the vessel didn't ask for help first, but confirmed that they wanted the help that was already on the way when asked. The Ports Department made the initial call to emergency responders. By the time local emergency responders reached the vessel, the fire had been suppressed. Since the Noble Discoverer was not tied up at the dock, responders did not board. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith said in an email those emergency responders weren't necessary in the first place and that Shell did not call for them. He adds there was a backfire in one of the stacks on the Discoverer. There was a small residual flame in the stack that was put out almost immediately by crew members. The Discoverer was never in danger, and there are no injuries. There haven't been any reports of damage to the vessel. Unalaska Fire Chief Abner Hoag says the crew told him the engine that backfired had been acting up for a couple of days.
Completely contained and under control, and they requested that, or advised that they don't need any shoreside assistance. So we're going to go back home.
The Noble Discoverer just returned from the Chukchi Sea, where it had been drilling top holes as part of Shell's Arctic drilling program. Alaskans and coin collectors from as far away as the lower 48 were in Healy yesterday for the U.S. Mint's official launch of a new Denali National Park quarter. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Bags of the newly minted quarters were symbolically poured into a gold pan at the crowded Tri-Valley Community Center in Healy. Hundreds of local school kids, like Anderson second grader Kayla Irwin, received a shiny first issue quarter.
It says United States of America. Denali, Alaska, 2012.
What's the picture?
A doll shape with him on a mountain. Mountain McKinley.
Denali National Park Acting Superintendent Jeff Mao says having a Denali coin in circulation will help perpetuate the park's iconic status.
Traveling around the world, it's always interesting to see what countries will put on their currency. And, it's just exciting to have Denali National Park on that piece that people from around the world will see.
The Denali Quarter is part of the U.S. Mint's America the Beautiful series. U.S. Mint Denver, Colorado plant manager David Croft says the project follows another popular quarter program.
National Park Series was introduced after we did the State Quarters program. We completed all 50 states, the five territories in Washington, D.C., and then there was an idea to do the same thing for all the national parks. So similarly, we're doing the national parks in every state, the five territories, and Washington, D.C. So this was the 15th coin in that set, and we're going to be doing 56 coins in total.
Croft says 200,000 of the 200 million Denali quarters produced were delivered to Healy for the first issue. Hundreds of rolls of the new coins were sold at face value at a Healy bank. The issue drew several avid National Park quarter collectors, people who travel the country buying up the first issue coins.
My name is Chuck Taylor, and I'm from Springfield, Illinois. And I have made 14 of the 15 quarters now, so I've been to the 14 ceremonies out of 15.
The 70-year-old Taylor says his love of national parks got him into collecting the new quarters. Following Thursday's Denali coin issue, Taylor was busy stamping $10 rolls for collectors at the Healy Post Office, an independent service he provides for free.
They put a postage stamp on the roll of quarters, and we roll an image onto it, like a first-day issue or first-day cancellation type thing. It documents that they got it here today. It makes it more collectible.
Taylor bought over 4,000 Denali quarters, some for himself, but most to sell to other collectors. He says profits usually are enough to cover his travel expenses. In Healy, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, thinking of buying a parrot? Think again.
Because you buy the flash, and what you get is the responsibility you weren't expecting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. take daily medication, and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
The Hoonah man who was convicted this month of a murder of two police officers wants a new trial on whether one of the officers was actually in performance of his official duties. The difference could mean as much as 79 years taken off his potential sentence. Matt Miller has more from KTOO in Juneau.
A jury returned with guilty verdicts against John Nick Marvin Jr. on November 3rd. They also issued findings of fact on whether Sergeant Anthony Wallace and Officer Matthew Tokaoka were clearly identifiable police officers. Wallace was on duty and in uniform during the shooting of August 28, 2010. But Tokaoka had not yet reported for duty that night and was not yet in uniform. Marvin could be sentenced to anywhere from 20 to 99 years for Tokaoka's murder, but a straight 99 years for Wallace's murder, because the sentence for first-degree murder of a police officer is defined in statute. Marvin's attorney, public defender Eric Hedlund, wrote in a motion filed November 5th that Wallace's socializing with the Tokaoka family was not part of his official duties. Hedlund has called for a new trial to make that determination. It's unclear, though, if it would be another jury trial or a bench trial in which only the judge makes such a ruling. Hedlund calls Wallace pulling up behind the Tokaoka's vehicle on Front Street in Hoonah and a patrol vehicle a sham traffic stop. Hedlund also refers to a civil lawsuit filed by Haley Tokaoka against the city of Hoonah that Wallace shined his flashlight at Marvin's house for no reason, instead of an official reason like investigating a potential crime. According to testimony during the trial, Tokaoka may have been worried that Wallace's flashlight would antagonize Marvin. It was perhaps minutes later that Marvin fired a rifle from a second-story window of his home. District Attorney Dave Brower opposes a new trial, writing that Wallace was in the midst of performing his official duties, and a jury has already made that determination beyond a reasonable doubt. Brower refers to an example of a beat cop who might stop and chat with a store owner for a few minutes. No indication from Superior Court Judge David George yet if or when the motion for another trial would be granted. Meanwhile, no hearings have been scheduled yet in Haley Tokaoka's lawsuit against the city of Hoonah. Tokaoka alleges negligence because Wallace allegedly breached his duty of care to the Tokaoka family. She also alleges negligent training and supervision, negligent infliction of emotional stress, loss of consortium, which is a loss of companionship and support, and breach of contract because benefits like life insurance that allegedly were not provided. Juneau attorney Mark Choate is seeking general damages in excess of $100,000 and special damages for medical and burial expenses, loss of Tokaoka's earnings, interest, and attorney's fees. According to electronic court records, the city of Hoonah has not yet responded to the lawsuit and has not yet retained an attorney for the case. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
A commercial fisherman who was a former associate of disgraced Highliner and congressional aide Arnie Fugelvog will have to pay $100,000 for his own illegal fishing activities. 47-year-old Freddie Joe Hankins was sentenced last week to 3 years probation and will have all of his future fishing activities recorded by an electronic monitoring device. $25,000 will be in the form of a fine and $75,000 will be a community service payment. He'll also be required to have a statement acknowledging his wrongdoing, published in a National Fisherman magazine. Federal fisheries investigators allege that Hankins harvested about 47,800 pounds of black cod that were counted toward his individual fishing quota for the Central Gulf of Alaska area when the fish were actually caught in the western Yakutat area by Fugelvog's boat, Camellia. The fish allegedly had a value of more than $222,000 and was eventually transported across state lines from Yakutat to Seattle. Hankins is a Cove, Oregon resident. The longtime leader of the Bethel Search and Rescue Team is stepping down as president. Citing obligations to the health of family members, Peter Atchak has submitted his resignation to the all-volunteer organization. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Trim Nick has more.
Every time there is a missing person or a drowning in the Bethel area, Peter Atchak is there. Since Atchak assumed leadership in the late 80s, the Bethel Search and Rescue Team membership has grown and the organization has expanded over the years. They now have headquarters in Bethel, modern search equipment, and membership of 90 volunteers. Mike Riley will be assuming Atchak's duties as interim president.
Throughout the years, Peter put in a lot of time, personal time, in the search and rescue efforts of certain people out there that were lost. And he worked very closely with the village VPSOs and also the village search and rescues throughout the region.
Trooper pilot Earl Samuelson also worked very closely with Atchak over the years. Samuelson says his work was not confined to missing persons or marking trails around Bethel. He was instrumental in helping other search and rescue teams get started.
He's done a lot of communicating out to the villages, you know, talking on the Yupik line, going out to the villages and assisting with organizing other communities. And anytime there is a extended search, he's always willing to step up and go to the other community and in Bethel too.
Peter Atchak, originally from the village of Chivak, shared a little bit about his work with the all-volunteer group.
When I first started getting officially involved, like a member, official member, you know, it used to give me like a feeling of satisfaction of helping out. So I really went for it, you know. So anytime there was something going on with search and rescue, I would drop everything I was doing to go help out.
Although Peter Atchak will no longer lead the Bethel Search and Rescue Team, he plans to continue to help out as a member. In Bethel, I'm Trim Nick.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office in Alaska is bracing for an exodus of expertise. 40 to 50 employees, just under 10% of the workforce, are expected to retire December 31st to take advantage of a window to boost retirement pay. Agency spokesman Bruce Wood says hundreds of years of experience will be lost with the departures. The agency manages 16 wildlife refuges in the state. The refuges total nearly 120,000 square miles, an area about the size of New Mexico.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Stephanie Joyce. This week on AK, parrots. Although the sale of wild-caught exotic birds has been banned in the United States for decades, commercial breeders in the country make a variety of parrots and parakeets available for pet lovers. But they're challenging pets, and because some owners give them up, there are more parrots in Alaska than there are homes for them. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has this profile of two women working to solve the problem.
Amber O'Neill is for the birds. She's the president of the Alaska Bird Club, and any conversation that takes place in Hart Nunaka Valley home will definitely include comments from her parrots.
Hello.
Amber lives with three parrots. Twiggy is the loquacious African gray.
Okay.
Bye, Twiggy.
See you later.
Bye.
Treat. Bye.
Junior, a bronze-winged pionis, and Janie, a small conure found outdoors, are relatively quiet compared to Twiggy. Talkative Twiggy is adopted. Her first owner had her 13 years and gave her away for personal reasons.
Hello.
But who could not love a talking parrot? Well, it seems a lot of people. That's one of the big problems with owning a parrot. Life changes, marriages, deaths, relocations happen to us all, and a parrot pet, in most cases, is a pet for life and beyond.
Sometimes people will pass the bird down to the next generation, but sometimes the kids don't want the birds. Very often, if someone moves or has a child, the person or couple will decide, you know, maybe the bird shouldn't be in their life anymore.
Finding homes for lost or unwanted birds is one of the bird club's big challenges. Amber calls it rehoming.
The big birds are a huge commitment. It takes somebody who knows what he or she is doing. You'll have cockatoos, macaws, Amazons. We have a lot of those in our adoption program because you need to kind of be fluent in bird before you get one of those.
Janie's owner was located but didn't want her back, and 24 bright parakeets now housed in big cages in Amber's home were found flying free outdoors in Alaska. Some people, like writer Elise Puktatuk, put their parrots in their will.
These critters live to be 80, 90, 100 years old. So their possibility of being thrown away increases by the amount of years they live.
Elise's living room is dominated by two huge parrot cages in which Captain, Sibi, and Abdullah reside. Captain is the only bird that started out as her pet.
Captain and I are going on close to 35 years together, which is more than most marriages I know.
Captain's cage mate, the dazzling all-white Australian bare-eyed cockatoo named Sibi, was sold on the streets.
And normally you would never put two different species like this in the same cage, but I got her in 83 in Barrow and there was no place else for her to go. And I only had one cage and I didn't know any better back then, so I put them in together and now they're like the odd couple. They're the bonded pair. I can't separate them.
Sibi has found a good home and a good companion, but the African gray, Abdullah, still misses his first owner. Parrots have the emotions of a 3-year-old child, Elise says, and get attached to their owners. Downstairs, Elise shows me 4 more birds. 2 are foundlings, 2 are rejects from a parrot breeder.
Baby and Kenya came out of the home of a breeder who, I guess the nicest way to put it that I can think of is to say fell on hard times and got sick. And towards the end, they were very, very neglected for many years. So they had it very difficult. Sassy, the one Senegal on the end there, and Wilson, the Kenya, were both found outside.
All 4 perk up with the attention. Elise takes Sassy out of his cage, and he immediately nestles into her shirt.
I mean, I'm holding him. I can hold him upside down. I can put my face in his belly. I can love him. He won't hurt me. He won't bite me. And Sassy is just one of my favorites. I mean, he just wants a home where someone will let him love them.
She's adopting the 2 birds from the breeder because of their special needs. Sassy and Wilson will be fostered until suitable homes can be found. Elise says it takes a certain person to keep a parrot pet.
One of the things we try and talk to people about if you're thinking of adopting a parrot is to research. It's kind of like a dog. You know, you have little dogs that are yappy little ones, then you have bigger dogs that are kind of laid back and friendly, and then you have other dogs that are more guard dogs. And birds are the same way. People think bird is a bird. It's not.
The Bird Club has helped to educate pet stores to not sell the longest-lived larger birds like macaws or Amazon parrots. Amber O'Neill says that may help reduce the number of parrots she needs to rehome. The Bird Club and a sister group, the Parrot Education and Adoption Center, are working to match unwanted or lost parrots with committed and bird-educated owners. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to the southeast community of Craig on Prince of Wales Island.
My name is Victoria Merritt. I'm the Recreation Department for the City of Craig on Prince of Wales Island. Craig was originally a fishing village. It was a series of islands connected now by causeway to Prince of Wales Island, which is the 3rd largest island in North America. It's the retail center of the island of Prince of Wales. It's very affected by the weather and fishing, and it's beautiful, but it rains about 12 to 14 feet a year here. A lot of that rain comes right straight at you in the wind, so it's windy and rainy, but when the sun is out, it's absolutely beautiful, and you learn to like the beautiful grays and greens as well. We have several fish processing plants here, and we have the Forest Service. Most of the timber from the Tongass comes from Prince of Wales. So logging is sort of is waning days, but we're still a very strong fishing village. We have the Forest Service here as well. There's a lot of strong tourism in the summer. We have the hardware store, we have a grocery store. There's also one in Klawock, which is just 6 miles away. But we have, the clothing stores and two banks. If you need stuff, this is where you come. We have bazaars coming up. There's one in Thorn Bay, and then we have two in Craig. So those are art and craft bazaars. The schools are all giving their holiday concerts coming up shortly, and then we have a concert for a thrift store here that helps families in need with food and emergency resources. And we have a huge concert that we do every year in December, so people are starting to practice and get ready for that. Never a dull moment. We have open gym volleyball. We have roller skating for the kids. There's lots to do, don't you? If you say there's nothing to do here, I take that as a challenge.
Victoria Merritt is the recreation director in Craig. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ellen Lockyer, Dave Waldron, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friednauer in Haines, Stephanie Joyson on Alaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Trim Nick in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.